One interesting fact, after you left NASA and the shuttle program that you're working on, I saw in a note here that you were flying as part of the movie Tora, Tora, Tora and had an engine failure. Is that correct?
No, and I wasn't involved in a movie. That was actually after I flew Apollo 13 and before I flew the shuttle.
Okay.
This was 1973.
Right.
In 1973, I was doing sport flying. That's when I was in the Orbiter Project Office
Okay.
during that time. And I did sport flying with an operation that did air shows using flying World War II vintage aircraft. And I was involved with using these aircraft that had been bought very cheaply from 20th Century Fox,
Oh, okay.
who had modified a number of aircraft to resemble Japanese aircraft for that movie, Toro Toro Toro, The Attack on Pearl Harbor. And we had about five look-alike Japanese Zeros. They were actually Canadian Harvards, which is like a Texan T-6 or Navy SNJ. And the one I flew most time was a dive bomber, the BAL, Japanese dive bomber, which was a converted BT-13 that they'd added a dorsal on, and they had put pants on the landing gear and changed the cowling on the front. And we had a couple of those, and then we had one or two torpedo, the Kate aircraft, a torpedo bomber, which was another modified BT-13 with even a stretched fuselage. And so those were the aircraft we had, and we always did the opening act of these air shows, where effectively we took off early and got off away from the field so people didn't know we were there, and then we'd come roaring in and stage the attack on Pearl Harbor. And of course they had pre-staged all kinds of pyrotechnics and explosions out in the center of the field, and that all went off. And then there was a P-40, Joe Engel flew the P-40 at most of these air shows. And the B-17 would come across, and it had gotten shot, and it trailed smoke. And the P-40 would get in a dogfight with the Zeros.
Fantastic. That's
So it was
awesome.
that kind of a thing. And the one day I was ferrying the Val from Angleton, Texas, not too far southwest of Houston, where we kept it at a crop dusters field. Those aircraft we kept at a crop dusters field, sod field down there. And I was ferrying it to Galveston Shoals Field to get it on a wash rack. We had a wash rack we could use there to clean up the aircraft, because we had an air show coming up on the weekend at Dallas-Fort Worth. And I was too close on an airplane ahead. It's actually been flown by Ted Mendenhall. We flew in formation down. And the landing pattern, I got too close on Ted. He was one of our shuttle-trained aircraft pilots. And I lost him over the nose on the runway and decided to put the power on and go around rather than overrun him on the runway. And right at the upwind end, as I got to the upwind end of the field, the engine quit, 300 foot in the air about. So I managed to change fuel tanks, which I knew shouldn't have been a problem. The fuel tanks were both full. But I changed to the other fuel tank and pumped the wobble pump manually, pump for fuel pressure. And I could get it to cough and sputter now and again. And I milked it around 180 degrees to on the west side of Shoals Field. Looked like a dirt field, which unfortunately turned out to be the start of a housing development. And this was a fixed gear plane. I couldn't pick up the landing gear. So one wheel went into a ditch that had been dug, and the cartwheel ended up going upside down backwards, canopy jam shut and on fire.
Oh.
Oh.
So before I could kick a hole through the canopy, the old World War II type plexiglass canopies, and got a hole big enough, I crawled out. I had gotten burns over 65%, and got to spend the next 3 months in the University of Texas Hospital at Galveston. The grafting was done actually by Shriner Burn Institute doctors that were right next door to that UT hospital. They had a sort of a teaming agreement partnership with UT Adult Ward, Burn Adult Ward, there to do that kind of work, and also train UT residents who were budding to be plastic surgeons. So they helped train them as well. Now, so anyway, that's where I was treated.
You now in your later life, you have some association with those groups, don't you? You do some charity work or support some charities in that area now, is that correct?
I did, but I'm not doing it today, not for the shrine. I did it for a number of years.
Right.
The management changed, and then they quit inviting me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But no, it took me 14 months to get back to flight status.
Right.
Had a lot of physical therapy, and so eventually I did get back, and of course I was named Command Crew 1 of the Enterprise.
Sure, sure. Right. All right, Fred, I'm looking at the clock here, and I've taken way too much of your time. If you don't mind, I've got just a few questions. What I did in preparation for this interview, I went to collectspace.com, and there's a forum there of quite knowledgeable people, and I asked people if they would like to ask a question of you, and if you wouldn't mind, I'll just ask a couple of them, if that's okay.
Okay.
You touched on it before. This is from a member called Frau Morrow. What thoughts came to mind when you saw the crew of Apollo 14 exploring the Frau Morrow Highlands, which was in fact the intended landing site for Apollo 13? Did you think that you and Jim Lovell would have made it to the top of Cone Crater?
Well, first of all, one of the things I did was I volunteered to be the Capcom on Apollo 14 and worked with Jerry Griffin's team, because that put me in the cycle that I could cover their second EVA, which was the call it the geology exploration up to Coon Crater. And so I thought maybe having trained to do that, I could be of some help to help them in that, and the mission they had then to complete. I really can't answer the second question. If we could have made Cone Crater, I think the problem is typical on the moon is, the moon is just a regolith and a bunch of rocks thrown around, and navigation is a real problem. They did not have the later rovers where there was a simple but nevertheless a navigation system, so it was quite difficult. In fact, in a way, I was happy they maybe didn't get to the edge, because had somehow it, I don't know how abrupt that would have been, but if you'd fallen in the Cone Crater, you would have not gotten out.
Right.
So I guess afterwards, looking at the data, they got very close to the rim. It really wasn't that important, other than maybe have the, say you did it and have the view inside the crater. The exercise was to collect rocks on the pathway up, leading up to the edge of the crater. The way meteorites impact, it's much like the underground nuclear explosions we did. It causes an unflapping. When it explodes, the meteorite hits and all that energy, it implodes outward. So the deeper rocks are at the end of the trail.
Right.
Further away from the crater. So it's like a trail of rocks that come out in all directions. So by sampling up that trail, so to speak, up the flank, you're collecting from the deepest to right at the rim, you're getting essentially surface rocks, which sure. You could collect anywhere around that area.
Sure.
So they had gotten almost to the rim, so they had done the collection of what was important, the rocks from deeper down in the crater.
Another question from member LM12. Did you don your spacesuits at any time on Apollo 13 after the explosion for staying warm or any other purpose?
We thought of that, but you have to realize the lunar module only has two sets of hoses, and one set was tied up with the lithium cartridge. And the reason I say the hoses are essential is because if you put on a spacesuit without the hoses hooked up to provide cooling air, you would sweat, you'd perspire. And so we worried about getting into the suits, and if you didn't have that cooling air perspiring, and now if you had to go to the restroom, bathroom, crawling out of that, being soaking wet now with perspiration in that cold environment. So we decided that and only one person could possibly at a time have the availability of the cooling air, we decided just to rough it. We put on all our spare underwear. I think we had a couple extra sets, so I had three sets of underwear on. and our two-piece outer garment.
David C. asks, while you were serving as backup commander for Apollo 16, you flew the lunar landing training vehicle. How much more demanding was it to fly in lunar simulation mode than in jet engine gimbal locked mode?
Well, I'm not sure the gimbal lock term, but it was a more difficult task because we not only had to control attitude in that lunar landing training vehicle, but also continually work the two rocket hydrogen peroxide rockets firing downward to arrest the descent properly. That particular control system was never employed on the actual lunar landings. Attitude control was done, of course, but the final landing descent was controlled with a little toggle switch that could tell a computer to change sink rate. And each toggle represented 1 foot per second. So the final adjustments for landing through the descent engine was really done with a little toggle switch as you got closer to the ground to refine your sink rate properly as to a landing.
Sure. Another question. Which Gemini and Apollo launches did you attend at the Cape? Did you go out to many launches yourself?
I don't think I went to any Gemini launches. I arrived in the program at about the time Gemini 8 flew. I think it was when Neil and Dave Scott aborted on that mission. And I don't think I went to any Gemini launches. I went to pretty much, I didn't go to the first Apollo unmanned launches. I did not go to Apollo 7. I went to all of the, starting with Apollo 7, I went to all the launches except my launch. You get to see that. And I was not there for Apollo 17, the night launch. I was actually off at Harvard Business School at that time.
So after you were backup commander for Apollo 16, I believe you were assigned to Apollo 19?
No. The situation was getting into that slot as John Young's backup commander. The initial crew I had was Bill Pogue, command module pilot, and Jerry Carr, the lunar module pilot. Just as I've said before, it was a three-mission cycle, so that kind of put us into the alignment that we expected, at least, had we followed through and the missions had been retained. When 16 was completed, we'd cycle to go fly 19. You know, it never was anything that was formally assigned and published in a paper or anything. Normally, that wouldn't have been done until after 16 flew. So what happened, about 5 months into that training cycle, they canceled 18 and 19. So Deke moved Bill Pogue and Jerry Carr off to the third Skylab mission so they could get a ride, because we were running out of seats at that time. And I inherited Stu Roosa and Ed Mitchell to finish out that backup assignment.
Fantastic. Well, look, Fred, I've taken way too much of your time. You've been very generous. I've got probably a million more questions I could ask, but maybe we'll do this again some other time. Really appreciate you taking the time, and if you ever get out to Australia, please look us up. We'd love to spend some time with you, and thank you again for your time.
Well, one thing I had not mentioned, we should have mentioned, is I mentioned we powered down. I figured to power down to 18 amps.
Uh-huh.
People on a mission control actually figured a way to get us down to 12 and a half amps.
Right.
One of the things that got us there was to enlist the help of the some of the big dish operators around the world who normally service JPL in the deep space probes, and one being Honeysuckle Creek in Australia. Now, I've talked many times, email still a lot, Colin McKellar, and he said they were asked to change their station to be compatible with our S-band communication, which they were not compatible with at the time. And he said they worked literally, her crews worked through the night, didn't go to sleep at all, to convert that station. And now with the bigger dish signal strength provided, we could turn off our power amplifier on board the spacecraft. That saved 2.5 amps.
Wow.
Which adds up. If you take 2.5 amps over 100 hours, that's a lot of amp hours. You know, kind of. So it really was a big jump that allowed us to go down, things like that allowed us to go down to that lower power level. And in essence, we were providing communication and high bit rate data from the moon, where we were effectively, without the power amplifier, and we only providing half an amp, 30 volts. So with 15 watts from the moon, we were providing high bit rate and communication.
Fantastic.
Voice communication.
Well,
yeah.
If listeners want to learn more about that, if they go to the website honeysucklecreek.net.au, they can read all about that and all of Australia's role in the Deep Space Network. It's a fascinating role that Australia played as part of a global network. And we in Australia really feel like we had a little bit of an important little bit of part of Apollo.
A big part, yeah.
Now, have you been to Australia, Fred? I meant to ask you that before.
I've been several times to, but only to Melbourne.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, Australia, to look, to really, you need to stay several months. Australia, as you know, is a big place.
Sure.
And it's quite different, I guess, from its north to south and east to west, just like U.S. is.
That's right.
So you'd have to spend a lot of touring time to see Australia.
Yeah. Well, Melbourne, that's where I'm from, and I love Melbourne, so I'm glad you made it to Melbourne, and maybe you'll get back here again soon. I hope that happens.
Right.
Fred Hayes, thank you again. Safe travels, and happy 45th anniversary.
Thank you.
Thank you.